The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Smith, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is June 29th, 2022. We're conducting this oral argument by Zoom. We have on our oral calendar today two consolidated cases, which is what we're here for right now. And the cases are A22-0148 and A22-0273 in the matter of the administrative penalty order and license suspension issued to Kevin McCulloch and Mission Tavern, Inc., DBA Mission Tavern, and in the matter of the administrative penalty order and license suspension issued to Norman Sugden. Counsel, although we have two cases, we have the same counsel on both, and we don't have any order making any changes. So the oral arguments will be 15 minutes for each of you for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Assuming no question. Oh, and when you start, each of you starts your principal argument, please state the name and the party or parties that you represent for our record. Barring any questions, we are ready to begin with the appellant's counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Richard Dahl, and I represent Mission Tavern, and who is in Merrifield, Minnesota, and Norms, which is over in Buffalo, Minnesota, little town up off of 94. Today, I'm coming and I'm appealing this case because if you look at the appendix to my Mission Tavern brief, I think you'll see something interesting. I fought the alcohol licensing issue with the Department of Public Safety. And last year, Judge LaFave said, based on NRA on-sale liquor license, 763 Northwest 2nd, 359, a 2009 case, that they didn't have jurisdiction or authority to otherwise pursue the license revocation of an alcohol license of Mission Tavern. And I attached those documents. And what happened in that case was just really this simple. After the ruling, the Department of Public Safety and the Division of Emergency Management that they're under didn't do anything. They sat on it for an entire year, and finally Judge LaFave said that's enough. And the reason they sat on it is because they know that the Emergency Management Act has not given them no authority whatsoever to revoke licenses. There is no authority.
Excuse me a minute, if I could just ask a quick question here. Liquor licensing is done by local government. DPS does not issue liquor licenses. Isn't that right?
They do not. They do food licenses, but I'm going
I'm talking about, you said DPS was the party in your other case dealing with the liquor license. Is that
actually
right?
They oversee liquor licenses. Minnesota Department of Public Safety oversees liquor licenses. Yes.
All right, go ahead.
You can look at the case. You can look at the attached orders to my appendix to the Mission Tavern brief. It's right there. It's attached to that. I think the orders are like attached as the first couple of documents to the appendix to the Mission Tavern brief. So I want to just make a few points. Under 12.28, it says governor's orders, rules, enforcement. Every organization for emergency management established pursuant to this chapter and its officers shall execute and enforce orders and rules as may be made by the governor under authority of this chapter or 216C.15. And then it goes over, if you look at 12.04, Division of Emergency Management, it says Subdivision 1, Division created a division in the Department of Public Safety to be known as the Division of Emergency Management is hereby created under the supervision and control of the state director. The Commissioner of Public Safety may place a director's position in unclassified service, etc. So right there, there's only one organization denominated specifically in this, the Minnesota Emergency Management Act, to enforce this. That's the Division of Emergency Management, which is under the auspices of the Department of Public Safety. The only time that the Commissioner of Health or the Department of Public Health is mentioned is in 12.39, and that's MnSTAT 12.39, under the subject of vaccinations and under the subject of quarantine. So it's only under the subject of quarantine. And I've covered this. If you look, I've attached a copy of Anna Benelli's legislative analysis information brief from 2004 that discusses exactly what power they gave to the Minnesota Department.
Mr. Dahl, though, so you're arguing statutory interpretation, right? Because you're not saying the Department of Health doesn't have the authority to enforce general statutes, but you said under the general statute, the executive order is not an order, that the reference to orders refers to court orders. Was that your argument?
My argument, if you kick over to 144.09, or for, I'm sorry, 144.99 is a statute. I want to look at that. It's subdivision one. It says all rules, orders, stipulations, agreements, etc., and those are all referring to legal documentation or documents. And my point is that was originally what the governor was trying to say. So originally,
what's meant by orders? I thought your argument was that it refers to court orders. I mean, what is your argument on how we should interpret the word order?
It says rules, orders, stipulations, agreements, settlements, compliance agreements. Okay, those are all legal documents that come out of court. So the implication is that it's talking about court orders, and the like.
But don't the courts enforce their own orders? I mean, why would there need to be a statute? Can you give me some examples? Of why we should read the word court before the word order when we're interpreting that statute.
I am going to give you right here 4.035 on executive orders. It says a written statement.
No. I'm talking just now about 144. So why should we read court order? I understand, and I've carefully read your argument about executive order, and it says executive order, and this doesn't say executive order, but why should we read the word court into the statute in 144? Do you have any examples of MDH enforcing court orders?
No, but the point is, right now, it says in subdivision 104.03, denominated as an executive order. That means it's defining an executive order as the two words executive order. This says order in 144.99. So if it says in subdivision one is denominated as an executive order, it's stating that's how it's defined. Denominated would be how it's defined. Executive order isn't listed in 144.99. The only other argument that the state can make is that it's a law or later enacted for the preservation of public health. So under any other law now enforced or later enacted for the preservation of public health. Later enacted, as I've said, that's a legislative act. That's referring to the House, the Senate, and the governor signs something. That's not referring to.
But didn't the legislature enact Chapter 12, though? And so executive orders, when an emergency has been declared, peacetime emergency or, you know, whatever under Chapter 12, and it's been, the executive order has been approved by the executive council, it has the force of law. And that's the legislature said that. So then help us out here. How are
I'm trying to help
you
out.
Not, that this is not a statute.
It says,
so given all the rules of statutory interpretation.
You got to let me talk. It says it has the force and effect of law. It does not say that it is a law. And 144.99 subdivision one says enacted. That's referring to a law that's enacted. A law that's passed by the executive council is not enacted. That's not passed by the House, the Senate, and enacted. We're talking about something that has the effect of law. It's not a law because it doesn't continue after 30 days. So it has the effect of law, but it is not law. And if you read and look at the NRA liquor case, this court, not another court, this court says the city exceeded its express and implied legal authority by imposing conditions on Gabby's previously issued liquor license, because there's no statutory provision or municipal code that provides the city with the authority to conditional license when the city has no basis to suspend or revoke Gabby's license. There's no basis under the Emergency Management Act that this was ever intended. And I want to step back and I want to go back to the original reason that the state was enforcing this. And they were trying to justify this under 12.21. Specific 12.21 subdivision 3, the specific authority. And it says, in performing duties under this chapter and to the effect is policy and purpose, the governor may, then you got dropped down to 7, because that was what they were citing. Cooperate with the president and the heads of the armed forces, the emergency management agency of the United States and other appropriate federal officers and agencies, and with the officers and agencies of other states in matters pertaining to the emergency management of the state and nation, including the direction or control of, and it goes down to the conduct of persons of the state, including the entrance or exit from any stricken or threatened public place, occupancy of facilities. That's the justification that they're using in this case. And subsection 7 under subdivision 3 doesn't even talk about the Minnesota Department of Health. It talks essentially about the federal government and other states. And then you get down to subdivision or the sub 4, it talks about stricken or threatened public places. The MDH doesn't have the authority to determine a stricken or a threatened public place.
But they're acting pursuant, there are findings in the executive orders themselves, the basis upon which the executive orders were issued, including the fact that the United States Department of Health and Human Services Secretary has declared a public health emergency for the United States. I mean, isn't that the record on which we're, because I want to get now to your rational basis argument.
And the state justified this based on the Minnesota Emergency Act. If you're talking, we're going under federal law.
So the rational basis is, you're saying there's no rational basis because of the affidavit and other things you submitted at OAH, correct?
That's a different argument. I'm talking now.
I'm trying to switch to a different argument.
Okay, you're switching.
But finish your thought on what you were saying.
I'm saying on this that they don't have any authority. And the thing that also confirms this is 14.03 subdivision 1B. It says the Administrative Procedure Act does not apply to emergency powers in 12.31 to 12.37. That statute is like, it's saying you can't, this isn't about revoking licenses. And I'm telling you that the Department of Public Safety already knows this. They haven't said it explicitly to me, but they basically admitted it. As far as what you're talking about, here's what's funny, Your Honor, about this whole thing. They submit all this garbage from the federal government, and the CDC, for one thing, is not wholly owned by the federal government. It's an independent agency, not controlled by the executive branch, that has influence by big pharma and other whatever. And I mean, the fact of the matter is that they're telling us that there's an emergency and we got to rely 100% on them. is not only inappropriate, there's no judicial notice of the evidence, but those people have been influenced by other people. And I would note, and this is hilarious, and I think very highly ironic and funny, if you go look at the appendix, which I filed, Dr. Jensen files a brief or files an affidavit, and he cites the New England Journal of Medicine. This is Exhibit B attached to his affidavit. And at the top of this article written by, it was mainly written by Robert Redfield, but it says Anthony S. Fauci, MD, giving so the article cited by Dr. Jensen is in fact endorsed by Anthony Fauci. And it says that there's only a certain percentage of people that are going to die from this. And it's inconsistent with what the CDC officially said. And the CDC, as we all know, is influenced by a lot of factors and people that are going to make a lot of people a lot of money from selling a vaccine. And this is Minnesota. We're looking at our laws and not the CDC. And what the stuff that the CDC submitted isn't evidence. It's not evidence. And the state did not offer the opinion of anyone. They did in the Waffle case. They submitted Dr. Danilon, Richard Danilon's opinion, and he is an epidemiologist. And if you actually want an opinion from somebody on these issues, you need an opinion from an epidemiologist. That is the gold standard. Unfortunately, Dr. Danilon is not very credible because based on the statistics right in his own affidavit, the percentage of people actually getting sick in bars and restaurants was low. But if you add the two paragraphs together, which I've documented in this. The other thing is he relied on non-peer-reviewed studies from China and Vietnam. So
Mr. Dahl, if you could wrap up your principal argument, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
In my opinion, this case really involves an attempted quarantine of my client. And if you look at the Wake Forest journal that I've cited here, and you go to pages 4 and 5, bleeding over to that, it says more specifically, they concur the extensive body of law that the courts have articulated what due process requires when individuals are civilly committed. And they compared that to quarantine. And basically what they said, at a minimum, the requirement that quarantine be imposed only when necessary.
Mr. Dahl, who was the individual who was quarantined?
They quarantine every small business in the state.
No, but who was the individual who was the individual who was quarantined here?
My client and his business.
No, he wasn't quarantined.
They can a business can be quarantined if you look at the two subdivisions cited in 12.39. They can quarantine.
But they weren't quarantined, Mr. Dahl.
And that's what I'm saying is the effect of what the governor and this Department of Health tried to do was quarantine them. If you prohibit
people, well, I appreciate your enthusiasm, yeah. Mr. Dahl, but I don't think there was anyone who was quarantined here.
I disagree that, Your Honor.
Okay, that's fine.
We disagree on that point. So, I'm making the point because I'm preserving it if I need to appeal beyond today and even to the U.S. Supreme Court, because in effect,
thank you, Mr. Dahl. If you again, we'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And so I think we will turn to Ms. McKenzie, please, for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. As we've noted,
excuse me, Ms. McKenzie, I'm just going to ask just for everyone to mute if you're not speaking. Mr. Dahl, if you wouldn't mind muting. Thank you. It just makes the papers less intrusive. Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honors. As we've noted, both of these cases are results from enforcement actions taken by the Minnesota Department of Health for relators' intentional, serious, and willful violations of COVID-19 executive orders. In neither case do the relators dispute that they committed the violations and have instead focused their challenges on MDH's authority to enforce those orders. None of these arguments have merit. But I'd like to take a step back just for a minute and note that there's really nothing that unusual about these cases. The Minnesota Department of Health regulates restaurants in the ordinary course of business. And when a practice or activity is found to pose a risk to the public health or to be unhealthy in a restaurant setting, we regulate it. And here, MDH used its ordinary procedures and its normal statutory authority to regulate these restaurants. The only difference here is that the requirements came from an executive order having the full force and effect of law rather than another statute or administrative rule. And we started talking a little bit here about the Health Enforcement Consolidation Act of 1993, and in particular, Minnesota Statute 14499, Subdivision 1. And that statute gives health enforcement authority over a very wide range of measures intended to protect the public health. Two of those are orders and laws intended to protect the public health. And I think here, you know, the issue of whether executive orders are orders. The statute is not limited in any way as to what kind of orders are included. There is no, it doesn't say court orders. It doesn't say executive orders. It just says orders. And there are a variety of different kinds of orders that health may choose to enforce. They have their own cease and desist orders. There are executive orders. It is also, I think, possible that it could mean a court order. If, for example, the court were to order a restaurant to do something, and then the restaurant chose to violate that court order, health may say, well, we're going to take away your license because you failed to comply with the law. So, you know, despite the fact that courts obviously enforce their own orders, as your honors noted, it may be possible that the Department of Health would say, you know, you're in contempt of court, so we don't think you should have a restaurant license anymore. But there is no limitation, as the relator suggests, that would prohibit executive orders from being included in the term orders. And of course, furthermore, these executive orders, each order at issue in these cases was approved by the executive council and therefore has the full force and effect of law. So are therefore included as laws enacted to protect the public health. So they're separately enforceable under that provision.
So can I ask a quick question? And I understand your argument that that MDH was enforcing this under its authority to license food and beverage establishments. But going back to Chapter 12 and Mr. Dahl's argument about every organization for emergency management, does that necessarily exclude? How do we interpret that? Does that exclude MDH? Because I know that the incident command system was activated according to Executive Order 20-01. So is Mr. Dahl right or wrong in saying that every organization for emergency management does not include the Minnesota Department of Health?
Well, I think, Your Honor, if we just look at what that statute says, it certainly says that these emergency management organizations shall enforce the executive orders. And I think if we're really looking, it's to ensure that those organizations, these local organizations, comply with the executive orders. But there's no exclusivity provision. It doesn't say only emergency management organizations can enforce
these. Well, does MDH become an emergency management organization under the incident command system that Governor Walz activated with Emergency Executive Order 20-01? I mean, it talks about MDH. Do you have a position on that or not? And go on with the rest of your argument if you don't.
Yeah, you know, frankly, I hadn't considered that. It's possible. I think what the way that we've briefed the issue and the way if you read this, obviously peacetime emergencies are fluid and there are any number of entities or organizations that may need to enforce orders. And so I think in general, just the idea that, I mean, the default penalty, for example, under 12.45 is a criminal penalty, which county attorneys would normally enforce. So the idea that it's only these emergency management organizations is, it would render 12.45 superfluous. And so it's not an appropriate reading of the plain language of the statute, and reading all of these statutes together is
okay. Thanks. And I didn't mean to, take you sideways here, but
of course, Your Honor. Right. I'm happy to, of course, answer any questions you have. I think that relator's arguments about 14499 subdivision 1, any reasonable reading of the statute includes executive orders under health's authority. And, you know, furthermore, the orders themselves said this is what should be done. Agencies should use their existing enforcement tools to bring businesses into compliance with these orders. So it was contemplated expressly in these executive orders themselves.
So another question, should we read the executive order, which has the effect of law, and I heard Mr. Dahl's argument on what he thinks that means, but should we read it really as being a statute rather than under the order part of the statute, or does that not matter one way or the other?
I don't think it matters. I think it's separately enforceable under both. It's both an order and a law. So it could be enforced under either. And I think 14499 is intentionally very broad. It gives health a wide range of authority over matters related to public health intentionally, because health's role is to protect public health. So all of these issues that touch on public health are within their authority, particularly as to a food and beverage license, which has always been a very highly regulated area. And you know, relator's arguments related to Chapter 12, I think we talked a little bit about one of them, these Emergency Management Act arguments. They really suffer from, I think, similar deficiencies of failing to read the statutes in accordance with the rules of statutory construction and just plain language. I don't intend, in the interest of time, just to go into every one that they've made. I am happy to, of course, answer questions about them. But there is no exclusive authority in Chapter 12 for any organization or entity to enforce orders. And this is logical, given the fluid and dynamic nature of emergencies.
Just to be clear, Ms. McKenzie, so I understand, and I suppose it would depend on what a city has, but if there's a local governmental unit that has some authority to enforce health regulations within it, it too, depending on what its obviously equivalent to the health statute is, would have authority if it was similarly worded to enforce the executive order. Is that correct?
I think so, Your Honor, yes. For example, there are certain cities that have delegated authority over their own restaurants. Health enforces them in most of the state, but I believe Minneapolis, for example, does their own licensing. So yes, depending on what their authority said, they may also have that authority.
And could you speak to, and I'm not sure precisely where it fits in analytically, but appellant opened with a comparison to another determination by an ALJ regarding that liquor license revocation, et cetera. Could you respond to that, put that in context, and what is your response to that?
Yes, Your Honor. The DPS decision is really just irrelevant to this proceeding. They have their own statute, their own authority. It is a very differently worded statute than the Health Enforcement Consolidated Act of 1993. The law does not include these different categories. I believe, and I don't have it in front of me, but I believe that the wording is specific to a statute. It doesn't say a law, and it doesn't say administrative rule. It's a very narrow statute. And so, you know, Judge Lefebvre also, in analyzing this case, said that health does have authority despite saying that DPS didn't. And that's simply a function of the different language in the laws. We have to read each law independently. And this statute is very, very different than the DPS statute. So I don't think it really has any bearing on this case whatsoever.
So it was the same ALJ in one circumstance deciding that the authority provision relative to one agency held X. This, he looked at the authority for health under a different statute, and the determination was Y, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Exactly, Your Honor. And, you know, MDH isn't subject to DPS's regulatory authority, so it really has no bearing on the issue.
So can I just ask for a quick moment here about MDH's position, saying that, well, we're the only thing before the agency was whether, and now before a court on appeal, is whether there was a violation of the requirements of the executive orders, and not whether there was a rational basis for the executive orders to begin with. What can't they challenge that, and then in an enforcement action, and then what record are we to look at? Are we to look at the findings in the executive orders themselves, or
certainly, anyway,
and who has the burden on that, I guess, in front of this case, in the setting of this case?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm happy to address that. So I think that the relators did the appropriate thing in raising the issues in front of the ALJ to preserve them. But then they were obligated to brief them in front of this court, which they failed to do. So they forfeited the issues by not briefing them to Your Honors for a decision. I think the law is clear that they were obligated to make a record at OAH, which they did to a certain extent. And we did brief the issues before OAH. However, they then abandoned those arguments on appeal by failing to raise them. So they have been forfeited and therefore should not be subject of this court's decision. But I think if Your Honor is interested in our position, at that, we briefed the issue fairly extensively at OAH, again, to preserve the issue and create a record. And I think that the relators simply misstate what is required in a rational basis case. Although, again, the argument has been forfeited. You know, the fact that there is some conflicting evidence.
But it's not really forfeited in the sense that they do talk about the rational basis argument. And the affidavit that they submitted,
I understand, Your Honor. And to the extent that that your honors were to decide it had not been forfeited, I think the answer really is that in a rational basis case, the government does not have the burden to show that there is absolutely no dispute about a policy decision or a law, or that every published article in the world agrees with what the government did. Instead, a law is presumed valid. The party challenging the law has the burden to show that no reasonably conceived set of facts could support it. And here, the orders themselves are replete with evidence supporting them. And we did, in fact, put in evidence at OAH supporting the rational basis for the orders. And so, you know, the relators want to change the rational basis.
But don't we look, I mean, the orders themselves contain a basis. Isn't that the record?
I think the record also includes the studies and articles that the department put into the record at OAH. I think it's both. And there is more than enough evidence to survive a rational basis in the record. And plainly, the a rational basis case is not a battle of the experts where the courts decide who is correct. And that's not the inquiry. And I realize I'm out of time. So unless your honors have any further questions, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McKenzie. I do just have one follow-up question. So I guess the forfeiture on appeal is because, just when I'm looking at the table of contents of the appellant's briefs, it talks about there's a lack of rational basis to justify continued enforcement of the emergency orders, which would be different from the enactment of the emergency orders. And that's why you're saying that rational basis, the challenge to the orders themselves, is not preserved, or help me understand
that. Yes, I think that argument is really about the fact that the orders were rescinded, which is a different argument. They're relying on, I think, principles applicable to criminal law only to say that, you know, since the orders were rescinded, I don't think it's really a rational basis argument when you actually read it. But I think that's a different argument. I also think they make some in this quarantine argument, there's a certain amount of due process or something that they discuss, but it's really not the same argument that they made at OAH.
Okay. All right. Seeing no further questions, thank you. And Mr. Dahl, you have 5 minutes for a rebuttal. Let's hit your mute button, unmute, please, and we'll start you over again with the time. Make sure you have enough time.
What's really crazy about this today is if you look at 1403 and subdivision one, and it says the Administrative Procedure Act is sections 14.001 to 14.69 does not apply. And then to skip to B, emergency powers in 12.31 to 12.37. If that isn't an exclamation point to say that these powers do not apply to give the licensing authorities in the state the right to take these cases to OAH, the Office of Administrative Hearings, and take licenses away from people, I don't know what is, because that in effect says, we can't even be appealing this case to the appellate court because OAH had no authority or jurisdiction whatsoever. It's explicit. It's written in stone here. I don't know where you go with that. As far as the rational basis test, my argument on that was they offered nothing. They offered testimony or from employees just citing articles randomly who weren't in any way, shape, or form qualified to give a basis for that.
Dahl, isn't the basis for the executive order set out in the executive orders themselves? I mean, that's the record on which the executive orders are grounded.
Even
so, Jacobson, and they you know added extra things to that, but there's, you know, there's in the executive orders themselves.
If you go back to Jacobson and read Jacobson, even it required some evidence. They did not submit any admissible evidence in this case. It was, they didn't even get proper judicial notice for the evidence, which I think is a minimum a requirement. The other thing I want to address before I run out of time is the amelioration doctrine. And I cite State v. Thompson attached to my appendix. And State v. Thompson attached to my appendix is right on point involving a driver's license.
How do you get around the fact that the amelioration doctrine arises only in criminal cases?
I just cited
it. Are you saying this is a potentially a criminal case?
No. I cited State versus Thompson, and I attached the decision. It's a Westlaw decision, and it specifically uses the amelioration doctrine in the context of a driver's license, showing that administrative penalties can be affected by the amelioration doctrine. It's cited. I mean, I've got, if I need to, oh, here it is. It's on page RA4 of my addendum to the Mission Tavern case. It's RA 3-5, 219 W Westlaw 4409708 2019, citing MDHB Kirby. But it says that statutes that cover both criminal and administrative penalties or license revocation. That's what it says right on page two of the opinion. It's RA4 in my thing. So clearly it has been applied to administrative penalties, and there's nothing in the record to rebut that. And the statute says during the time and the extent the emergency exists, 12.32. It's put right in the statute. Again, I win. During the time and to the extent the emergency exists, 144.99 says law now in force, right in the statute. So I really don't know how the state gets around this. I think that this is really trouble for them, because I think between 14.03 and the other statutory things, they've got no standing or authority to do license revocation.
Mr. Dahl, could there be any administrative penalty if a restaurant is continuing to act in violation, you know, for days before, but by the time that the enforcement comes, the emergency is over? Is there no administrative penalty that can follow from intentionally violating an order, an emergency order?
I don't think they had any authority to do these orders. Period.
I understand that, but if we assume, let's assume, you know, for purposes of argument, it was another agency that you think had authority, another emergency agency that had authority. It can someone subject to that order intentionally violate it then with impunity if there's no penalty actually assessed during the time of the violation?
My answer is yes, because in America we have due process in the Constitution, and everybody's responsible to assert their rights under the Constitution, and including judges, including legislators, including everyone. As far as I'm concerned, a law that doesn't have a basis or authority in the Constitution or otherwise has statutory authority has no basis, and I can violate it with impunity. And a lot of people don't want to hear that. Yeah.
May I also ask before we leave, although I don't want to cut off my colleagues, if you have any questions, where in your brief did you preserve the argument that the executive orders as issued lacked a rational basis? If you can just point.
In the last section of my brief, I discuss the conclusions of our expert and the New England Journal of Medicine required MDH to submit sufficient admissible relevant evidence as required by the rules governing summary disposition to give MDH a rational basis to justify continued enforcement of the emergency orders. That's on page 14, 15, 16, 17, and 18. Of my brief for Mission Tavern, and I don't recall the pages for
okay. Numbers. Yep. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you both for your arguments. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out within the statutory time frame. That concludes our only oral argument on our calendar today, and we will be in recess to consider our non-oral calendar. Thank you.
I appreciate your time. Thank you for being patient.
Yep. Thank you.
Your Honors.